And now, back to the political cesspool with your host tonight, James Edwards.
I know nothing. Nothing.
And guest host, Bill Rowland.
And you have landed feet first in the political cesspool. I'm the co-host for tonight, Bill Rowland. And I'm here with James Edwards, the host, and I'm opening back up because the guest tonight is an old acquaintance of mine, and I'd like to say an old friend. Jared Taylor is the chief editor-in-chief of American Renaissance Magazine, the journal on race and culture, the preeminent journal on race relations, particularly as those relations affect white Americans. Mr. Taylor is a graduate of Yale University, raised by, I think, missionary parents in Japan, and it was quite an interesting man in his youth, and I understand he has told me a liberal who had a great epiphany about race and other matters. And so, Jared, welcome to the political cesspool.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Bill Rowland. Did you hear that?
I did hear that. How are you?
I'm doing well.
We always have surprises in the political sector. But
always glad to talk to Bill Rowland.
He is a good man and an astute one, as you are. Very scholarly work that you do. And let's just cover some of the basics. We've been talking about you for about 30 minutes. I don't know if you can hear it all the way over there. But what prompted you to write this book? Out of all the books and things you could have devoted the subject matter to, what prompted you to write this book on this subject and do the subsequent research it took to compile all of those intricate statistics?
First of all, this isn't really a book. It's a report. It's a research report. And fortunately, in terms of doing the research work on it, I had the very able assistance of a fellow named Ian Jobling, who did most of the work this time around. This is a report. Its title is The Color of Crime, and it's about differences in crime rates among different ethnic groups and racial groups. And also, it is a very careful study of the extent to which there may or may not be racial bias in the justice system. So it really does two things. First of all, it demonstrates that the criminal justice system treats criminals practically without any kind of discernible regard for race, treats them almost entirely equally. And as a consequence, the differences we find in arrest and incarceration rates reflect vastly different offense rates of people of different races.
Jared, what's the most dramatic finding, do you think, of this study? What thing really stands out?
There are lots of dramatic findings in here. Probably the one that surprises people is to learn that there's actually more black on white than black on black crime. Mm-hmm. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton always wringing their hands over how the idea that blacks are the number one victims of black violence. But in fact, when blacks commit violent crime, they choose whites as their victims 45% of the time, while blacks are their victims 43% of the time, and Hispanics about 10% of the time. So there's actually more black on white than black on black violent crime. When whites commit violent crimes, they choose blacks as their victims about 2.5% of the time.
Wow.
So blacks are very, very rarely victims of white violence, whereas whites are quite frequently victims of black violence.
Are there any statistics on... I'm interested about the tiny, almost non-existent number of whites who commit crimes against blacks. Are there any statistics on what those crimes are, the nature of those particular crimes?
Well, yes. To the extent that there are such crimes... probably the most common one is simple assault. In other words, that's what happens when you get into a fight and you bang up somebody. But that is the violent crime committed most frequently by whites against blacks. It's, of course, the violent crime most frequently committed by blacks against whites, because it's just generally the most common violent crime. You get into fisticuffs, and if somebody presses charges, that can be a crime. However, when it comes to, say, something like rape, A black man is about 120 times more likely to commit rape against a white woman than a white man is to commit rape against a black woman. With robbery, blacks are about 140 times more likely to rob a white man than the other way around. Now, to some extent, this is simply a reflection of the fact that blacks commit those crimes more frequently than whites do, and that even if you are selecting victims without regard to race, there are more potential white than black victims. But this does not account for all of it. I think there is a clear selection of white victims in certain situations, particularly in rape.
All right, now that's one of the things I wanted to address with you. The numbers that I have, I believe from your research, suggest that every year there are about 15,000 black-on-white rapes, but in that same year there would be fewer than 900 white-on-black rapes. Now,
that's right.
We've talked about the other statistics in regards to robbery, murder, things of that nature. The most provocative thing that I found, you're talking about how many times more likely blacks are to commit these crimes against whites.
Yeah.
That's bad enough in and of itself, but when you take into account that all of these crimes are being committed by blacks, yet they represent only 13% of the population, they're committing more than 50% of the violent crimes. That is staggering. How and why, in your opinion, could a race that represents 13% of our nation be responsible for 50% plus of the violent crimes?
Well, let's be a little bit more accurate about that. It's 50% and more of murder and robbery. Those are the violent crimes in which blacks specialize.
Okay.
As far as in the aggregate, they're found to commit about 35 to 40% of all violent crime, but their specialties are murder and robbery. The question as to why, well, we could have a whole program on the question of racial differences between blacks, whites, Asians, etc.
Let me ask you a specific question.
Yes.
James and I were discussing the economic dimension of these crimes. Is there indeed an economic factor that plays into the crime, or are the crimes you're talking about sort of evenly distributed throughout all economic, among blacks, that is, among economic levels?
No, within all races, poor people are more likely certainly to commit violent crime. In fact, almost all crimes, believe it or not, including white-collar crime, than people with money. There's always a correlation between poverty and crime, no matter what the race. However, I think it is spurious to assume that poverty explains crime. One of the aspects of this study is to do a correlation between areas in terms of the crime rate and such things as the poverty rate, high school dropout rate, unemployment rate, etc., because people often say that crime is a result of social disadvantage of this kind. Well, the fact is, if you were going to predict the violent crime rate of a state or a city or a neighborhood, there's really only one piece of information that you need to know to get quite an accurate prediction out of it, and that is the number of blacks and also Hispanics in the area. You can make a prediction that is four times more accurate based just on the demographics of an area than you can by knowing the combination of the poverty rate, the high school dropout rate, and the unemployment rate. So in the United States today, the really powerful correlation that we have between violent crime and some other factor is race of the population. That's a finding that sometimes quite surprises people as well.
And of course, in the mainstream media lead, as we talked about in the first segment of this program, they go to great lengths to label people racist if they would not want to live in a predominantly black area, yet while they themselves live in the gated communities. But let me ask you this, and that is the, I think, epitome of hypocrisy. I think your research, and most of this, if I'm not mistaken, was compiled through the Department of Justice's own research.
Oh, these are all government statistics, unquestionably. The Bureau of Justice Statistics does not do a very good job of presenting the data in terms of race and racial differences, but the numbers are all there if you're prepared to dig through them and get at what's really going on.
And that's what you did in this scholarly work of yours. So with that being the fact, and this isn't even a debate at this point, it's a fact. These are government statistics.
Yes.
Blacks commit more crimes than other races. a very simplistic question here, but the answer is probably going to be more complex. And there's a lot of theories as to why. But why? Why does this happen? Why do blacks commit more crimes? And is there an answer?
Well, I think that the best research we have today indicates that crime is associated with low IQ. Prisoners, no matter of what race, tend to have an intelligence that is considerably below average. Prisoners also, violent prisoners, tend to have a higher level of blood testosterone than people who are not violent prisoners. And in fact, the combination of low intelligence and high testosterone very frequently leads to criminal behavior. And as it happens, blacks in general have IQs that are on average 15 points lower than those of whites, and they have a level of blood testosterone that's considerably higher. So in that sense, you could say that nature has dealt blacks an unfortunate hand when it comes to crime. They're more likely to have this combination of low IQ and high testosterone than people of other races. I might point out that the Asians are at the other extreme. They have an average IQ that's slightly higher than that of whites, and their testosterone levels are lower. And across the board, they commit crimes, both violent and nonviolent, at approximately one quarter of the white rate. With the result that if you're comparing blacks and Asians, you'll find that when it comes to crimes like robbery, for example, a black is about 60 times more likely to commit robbery than an Asian. I mean, these are staggering differences in populations.
So we're talking, I guess we would say it's genetics, and it does have to do with IQ. Now, this is not confined to America. You know, sometimes if you can get someone to honestly discuss the IQ statistics and other things, as we're talking about here, they would say, well, it's because the white government of America has suppressed the black community for so long, and that is why their IQs are low. But it's not just something that's unique to the continental United States. These are global truths. Am I wrong?
Well, in fact, to the extent that we have good crime rates and crime statistics from black and black-run countries, it's clear that their violent crime rates and other crime rates as well are far higher than white countries. In fact, the differences that we find in crime rates between the different races in the United States are precisely the same differences that you find if you compare black countries and white countries. Now, I would not say that the differences are exclusively due to genetic factors, because blacks are frequently brought up under circumstances in which, if someone was genetically predisposed to go either way, they are brought up in circumstances that are going to push them more in the direction of crime. For example, blacks now have an illegitimacy rate of about 70%, 70%. Illegitimacy, growing up in poverty, growing up around other criminals, all of those things tend to increase the likelihood of criminal behavior. So it's a kind of a combination. They start out at a disadvantage from a genetic point of view, but their environments also push them in a direction that's disadvantageous as well. But so they're getting by a double whammy in that respect.
But isn't it possible, too, that the high illegitimacy rate among blacks is also has a racial component, though?
Of course. So these things tend to build on each other. You get a group that does have a low IQ and also what's called a short time horizon. Criminality is very commonly associated with an inability to defer satisfaction, a sort of a smash-and-grab attitude. I'm not going to work so that I can buy that watch in the future. I'm going to hit somebody over the head and rip it off his wrist right now. This inability to go through a certain amount of privation in the present so as to get rewards in the future.
Do you think that's what happened in New Orleans with the after the hurricane, that there was this exactly what you said, smash and grab mentality? Here's the opportunity, let's take advantage of it, with no forethought given to the possibility of a flood or being trapped where you know the crimes are being committed.
Well, a good number of blacks who stayed in New Orleans were perfectly brazen about explaining that they stayed behind specifically so that they could have an opportunity to loot. People knew very well that folks were going to leave their houses behind. They anticipated that if there were power lines down, electricity was off, or roads were blocked or flooded, the police couldn't get around. So they knew very well it was going to be a perfect opportunity for looting. This is something, though, that happens quite predictably whenever there is a catastrophe of this kind in a large black area. When the lights go out in Harlem, they come out and they start looting. This is something that anybody with any brains could have and should have predicted. In the case of New Orleans, what is even more surprising than the looting, which I say is anyone could have predicted that, is people deliberately taking shots at rescue helicopters or rescue vessels, making it impossible to evacuate hospitals. There are a number of cases of ambulances being attacked and hijacked and tipped over. I mean, this is real barbarism that surprised even me. Even no matter how smash and grab one's mentality is, when helicopters are coming around trying to rescue people from rooftops, to take a shot at people doing that kind of thing, that really goes way beyond the bounds of even just ordinary criminal behavior.
That's very interesting that you bring that up. James and I discussed that right after the Katrina disaster down there, and these very specific things. In fact, I mentioned to James, I said those people stayed behind to loot. They didn't get trapped. They stayed behind to loot. Is there anything to account for that sort of increasing lawlessness, that sort of almost mindless violence? For instance, shooting at helicopters, shooting at ambulances. Is there anything in the research that would point to any sort of escalation like that? Because it seems similar to what has happened in South Africa to a large extent, that when the boundaries broke down or were removed, that the violence has only escalated to points of almost where it can no longer be controlled.
I'm not sure that we're looking at entirely the same phenomenon here. I think that, in fact, crime rates, violent crime rates in the United States have been going down. They've hit their peak, maybe about the early 90s or so, mid-90s, and have been going down for maybe, 6-7 years, and then have leveled off for the last few years. I think, by and large, that has to do with a sharp increase in incarceration rates. We have now nearly 2 million people in jail, and every felon is estimated to commit about a dozen felonies when he's out on the street. So every time you lock one of those people up, you're cutting down on the crime rate. And I think the get tough on crime policy has borne fruit in that respect. Now, when American blacks are taking shots at rescue vessels and helicopters, the only thing that I can imagine is that they are so alienated from American society and they are so resentful against whites that they're going to shoot at anything that they see as representing American authority, or they're going to shoot at any target that they think has white people in it.
And I think I just think our own eyes could tell us that most of the rescuers were in fact white. Natural disasters are certainly not unique to black areas like New Orleans. They hit all over the world and all over this nation. Yet, in no natural disaster that has hit a predominantly white community have we seen the kind of carnage that came out of New Orleans. I think that's the fact that we talked about on this show last month. That's what Bill brought it up for tonight. So basically, it appears to me, in the short course of this interview so far, using the government's own statistics, we have determined that race is the biggest factor in determining who is going to commit crimes. We have chalked that up in a roundabout way as well because of the black IQ rate as well as maybe some genetic predispositions. The bottom line is this. This social engineering has gotten to the point now where it is costing lives. And why are the cultural Marxists who push this failed policy suppressing this information, such as the information that you document so well in your book? Why is that being suppressed by the mainstream media? I don't think that's racist to list facts. I don't think it's necessarily dogging out blacks. I think blacks need to look at this information as sternly as we need to look at it and try to come to some conclusions and work on ways to better themselves. Why is the media and the government suppressing these findings?
It's a complicated question. I really don't have a single good answer for it. I think that in the United States today, race is very much the big taboo. And it is such a taboo that if you simply publish and compile and organize government statistics in any way that shows non-whites in an unflattering light, you're going to be accused of racism. Well, we have really gotten into a sorry state if, by telling the truth, you're accused of committing a moral failing, because that's what most people think racism is, whatever that may be. It's certainly a moral failing of some kind. That just goes to show you how strong the taboo is. Well, why is the taboo about black crime rates or black IQ? Why is that taboo so strong? I think that it goes back to the fact that ever since about, the civil rights period of early 60s, maybe on into the 70s, this country has, in effect, staked its future, its very future, on the idea that racial groups are essentially equivalent and ultimately interchangeable. And we have poured a huge amount of institutional energy into promoting this idea, into banging it into everybody's heads. And when, after nearly 50 years of trying to make this multiracial experiment work, people are so committed to it that they very deliberately and tightly close their eyes whenever there is any evidence that it is not working. And it's a somewhat roundabout way of saying that facts of this kind, facts in this report that cannot be disputed, facts of this kind are so unpleasant and so damaging to the overall worldview of liberal America that people would rather shut their eyes than face the truth.
Mr. Taylor, let me tell you this from the bottom of my heart. That was just about the best answer I've ever heard. Basically, they don't want to admit they were wrong. The government,
exactly.
The cultural Marxists, and they were wrong.
They were spectacularly wrong, but they don't want to admit it. You could take a guy like Teddy Kennedy and rub his nose for years in the facts of racial differences in IQ, racial differences in crime rates, and I think that guy is simply too old to be able to admit, gosh, I must have been wrong. Those guys cannot be changed.
Well, Jared, let me ask you a question on the other end of the scale. Do you know of a single case in the history of this country in any industry, educational facility, social system, governmental system of any kind, where integration has actually worked as predicted, where the outcome was as the optimism, in other words, justified the ends? Have you ever seen that in any institution?
Well, some people would argue that the NBA has benefited greatly from integration.
I don't think it's integrated anymore.
Well, it was for a while. But no, in terms of neighborhoods, schools, institutions, there has never been a case in which, for example, test scores of students or crime rates in neighborhoods, that sort of thing, or illegitimacy rates, those things went in a desirable direction when a neighborhood went from white to either black or Hispanic. No, we have an absolutely consistent and unblemished record, if you will, of failure in all of these counts. Now, this is something else that to talk about goes right to the heart of the whole post-Civil War concept of what America is all about. And so despite the fact that in their own lives, and Mr. Edwards talked earlier about the extent of the hypocrisy on these matters, in their own lives, white people, even liberal white people, particularly liberal white people, they organize their lives so that they don't live in non-white neighborhoods, they don't send their children to schools where there are lots of people who don't speak English or lots of non-whites. They're very, very careful to do that. And yet, in their public pronouncements, they invariably strike a pose as if we are all going to live happily ever after in this never-never land of racial equality and just hold hands and sing kumbaya. It is an astonishing state of self-denial, self-delusion, and it can't keep up for that much longer.
No, it can't and it won't. There will be some kind of dramatic fallout here in America if we continue down this path. There has to be. Now, that is just one of the many, many double standards of extreme racial pandering, and indeed, I think it has now become we have a culture of reverse racism against the majority with our federal government. That's not anything new. We talk about many of these instances on this show, and there are so many examples of the double and triple standards. But I want to ask you one more question, Mr. Taylor, and I'll let Bill follow up with a question. Then we need to get the contact information about how people can purchase this book. But we talked a little bit about why the government would want to suppress this information, but why is it so important that people have this information? I really would say that a study of these findings should be in the home of every family in America. I think it would perhaps save their life. Why should people know these facts that are in your book, and what should their response be? Not move into the minority neighborhood?
Well, let's take a very specific example. I don't know if you all recall, but on March 11th of this year, a black man by the name of Brian Nichols went on a shooting rampage in a courthouse in Atlanta, and he shot a judge and a court reporter and a policeman's deputy. All of this was because he said that the criminal justice system was racist and biased, and he'd been held in jails. He looked around and he saw all these black people. He was convinced they were innocent, and so he described himself as a soldier on a mission to correct the wrongs of the criminal justice system. Now, a guy like encouraged in that kind of murderous delusion by the way our media portray the justice system every day of the year, I think it is possible to say that those three people would still have been alive if what is in this report were widely known and widely disseminated. At the same time, when Katrina came along, we have the National Guard and we have rescue workers showing up completely dumbfounded and astonished that they have got lawlessness and savagery on their hands. Well, any person who knows anything about the association between race and crime rates could have predicted exactly this problem. If we are serious about disaster relief, we should plot the country out into a very fine grid, so that we know exactly where the areas relief workers have to take guns and where they can walk safely just with shovels. As you said before, this is a matter of actually saving lives, and we ignore this kind of information very much at our peril.
And this isn't putting, I don't think, one group of people above or below anyone else. It is about saving lives. This is a very serious situation. The experiment has failed. There's never been any sign of proactive movement through these as I call them, the social engineering of the cultural Marxists. And we need to use the power we have through media, what little we have left that hasn't been taken from us, and get these facts out. And I am so thankful that people with your intelligence are putting these facts out. And in a very affordable way, how can people purchase this book and get more information about your work through American Renaissance?
The best way to do that is to go to our webpage, which is at amren.com. And there, your listeners can find out about our various publications. They can find out about our meetings. Our next meeting, the American Renaissance Conference, is going to be held last weekend of February. And we're expecting people from all over the world to that, to talk about these various problems, because the problems that we're describing here in the United States are common to white populations all around the world. And there are people all around the world who realize that we face a common threat and that we have to work together to solve these problems. But AMREN.com, that's the place to go to get this report, The Color of Crime, and to learn about everything else that American Renaissance is doing.
Do you have a venue for that conference yet, Jerry?
Yes, it will be at the Dulles Airport Hyatt Hotel, and it'll be the last weekend in February. The next issue of American Renaissance is going to have full details on who the speakers are going to be and registration and that kind of information. It's going to be an exciting time.
We actually had, you preempted us there, we actually had a mutual friend of ours from Louisiana call in before you came on the air tonight to ask for all of those details regarding the February 2006 American Renaissance Conference. That is the, did you say next to last or last weekend in February?
It's the last weekend in February from the, it's the 24th, 5th, and 6th of February.
And anyone can attend, and all the information, all the logistics and details will be in the next.
It'll be in the next issue of American Renaissance, and we will very shortly be putting it out on our webpage as well.
At Amarin.
Next week or so.
Amarin.com. It'll all be up on Amarin.com. Next week, they can also find more information about you and, of course, your book, The Color of Crime. And you are basically giving those away for $8.95. So I think everyone should have this in their home. I would encourage you to go to www.amarin.com. That's AMREN.com. Get more information about Jared Taylor and his book and the conference coming up in February. So, Mr. Taylor, let me tell you, thank you so much for coming on the program tonight to talk about your work. It was an honor to be able to share the stage with you in Montgomery earlier this summer at the convention there, and I look forward to working with you in the future. Is there anything else that we've left out that you'd like to cover?
Well, gosh, no, you've been very kind, and it's been my pleasure to be on your program, and it's a real pleasure to talk to my old buddy Bill Rowland again.
Well, Jared, one more question.
Yes,
if we've got time.
Yes.
The Hispanic population in this country will soon exceed that of the black population.
Well, it already does, actually.
Do you have any forecasts as to how that racial dynamic may play out in regards to the blacks and Hispanics?
Well, that's a very interesting question. People like Jesse Jackson and National Council of La Raza, which means the race, the Hispanic activist organization, occasionally they talk about trying to establish some grand non-white coalition to link arms and go against the white man. But it never seems to work out because blacks and Hispanics probably get along about as bad with each other as they do with anybody else. These days, there are high schools in California and some on the East Coast as well in which riots and violence between black and Hispanic students are so common that they have to lock the schools down every so often. They have policemen patrolling the halls, metal detectors at the doors, making sure that people don't smuggle in weapons so that they'll finish each other off. Likewise, it's very frequently a problem in jails in California and Texas in particular, in which the men are constantly locked down. If they let them mingle in common areas, the blacks and the Hispanics would be at each other's throats in a minute. So the idea of somehow the racial problems in America as being caused by white wickedness, that is completely and utterly disproven by the fact that blacks and Hispanics get along as terribly and as badly and as violently as they do.
I'm very glad you asked that question, Bill, because that kind of put a different perspective on it, took whites out of the equation and exposed more racial truths as the other races, how they deal with one another. And that was a very good question and a very good answer. And I think one thing's for sure, and God forbid if and when it ever should happen, should whites become one day the minority in this nation, as we are on track to become by, I believe, 2050, the laws and thought policing that govern minorities, I don't believe will apply to us then.
Yeah, Jared, well, let me mention this real quick. I don't know if you know about this. Our next guest is going to be discussing pending hate crime legislation on the federal level. Do you have any thoughts on that or any insights on that impending legislation?
And he's talking about Reverend Ted Pike going to be talking about the ADL's hate crime bill that's swifting through Congress right now.
Well, I've heard that it is on its way. I think that it would be absolutely terrible if that were to pass. The whole idea of hate crimes, of course, is criminalizing a point of view, which is something the United States has never, ever had before. In our country, traditionally, if you commit a violent crime, the thing that matters is not why you did it, but whether or not it was deliberate. If I stab a guy because he's fat or because I want to take his money, or because I don't like the cut of his jib, none of that makes any difference. If I stabbed him, I've committed a crime. Now, the idea here is that if I stab him because he's homosexual or because he's Hispanic or whatever it is, then that somehow makes the crime worse. The motive, not whether or not it was deliberate, that suddenly is brought into the picture. Now, this is very bad for all sorts of reasons, but one is that when blacks commit violent crime against whites, and this is far, far, far more common than the other way around in terms of per capita, in terms of absolute numbers, very rarely are their motives scrutinized for any kind of racial ingredient. So this microscope is almost always brought to bear on whites rather than blacks. Even so, On a per capita basis, blacks are still about twice as likely to be guilty of what are officially designated as hate crimes than whites. Now, just to digress another on a, one more briefly, on a different crazy double standard, when it comes to hate crimes, and this report on the color of crime goes into this in some detail, Hispanics are a victim category, but when they are perpetrators of hate crimes, they're described as white. So if a black commits a violent hate crime against a Hispanic, that's a Hispanic victim. If that Hispanic turns around and commits a hate crime against a black, he's counted as a white man, the very same guy. This is another completely cuckoo racial double standard that only befogs our view of what's going on in this country.
Well, I'm sure all of that and more can be found in your book, The Color of Crime, Race, Crime, and Justice in America. Bill, thank you for asking those questions. And Mr. Taylor, thank you for taking the extra time to answer them. And again, for being on the program tonight. We've got to have you back on soon to talk about this further. But until then, again, thank you for all the work you do on behalf of our cause and for making this book available at amren.com. And you have a blessed evening. We look forward to working with you long into the future.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time,
Jared. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, sir.
Jared Taylor, author of the book, The Color of Crime, Race, Crime, and Justice in America, www.amren.com. That's A-M-R-E-N.com. You can get copies of the book, learn more about Mr. Taylor and his work with the organization, and the February 2006 conference. Details will be added, I believe he said, next week.